Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? I got an interesting email this week. He says, thank you for taking my email in question. My girlfriend and I
listen to your show all the time. And I've got to ask you, I am a recovering sex addict, and my girlfriend and I are having some sexual difficulties, and I don't know what to do about them. I'm not sure if it's my addiction. I'm not sure if it's the fact that she doesn't trust me, or perhaps some combination of the both. Please advise. Well, I got to tell you, tonight's show is going to be very interesting. We're going to be talking about sober dating, and what is that? And, you know, I have no doubt that if you are a recovering sex addict or a recovering partner, you know that your life is actually different than the average person, right? That's a real understatement in that a lot of times you have to do things differently because of the addiction. And we're going to be talking about what is sober dating and how do you do that. As a relationship coach, like I had somebody who didn't have a sexual addiction today, and he was talking about the fact that he's just started dating a woman. He is dying to have sex, but he is purposefully going slow because he really wants to see, A, what is she made of? B, he knows he needs to work on the intimacy factor, the emotional intimacy factor. And C, he wants to see if the relationship can be any different than all the other relationships he's ever had. Now, again, if you are single and you're a recovering sex addict, you've got to go very, very, very slow. And I know that one of the myths about sexual addiction is that if you had more sex, you would have less addictive behavior. And I call that a myth because that is absolutely false. There is no way that sex addiction is tied in with the amount of sex you have. Now, true, I've got men and women that say, I'm not having sex, and I absolutely believe it's tied in. But what I know to be true is that there are a lot of couples that are having lots of sex, and their husbands or wives are still sex addicts. There is no correlation between how much you're having sex and whether you have sexually addictive behaviors. Whether if you're having a lot of sex, it doesn't mean you'll have less sexually addictive behaviors. So I want you to hang in there with me. I want you to hear what we have to say. I know that this is tough stuff. This is not necessarily what people want to hear. You know, let's face it, sex is a primal drive. It is a primal need. And most people want to think, oh, yeah, I can have sex right off the bat, and I'll go slow, I'll get to know the person. But sex can really interfere with emotional intimacy. So we're going to talk to you about how to go slow, how to have a good relationship with somebody, and then how to introduce sex. I'm a relationship coach. I talk to everybody about this, let alone recovering sex addicts or partners of recovering sex addicts. So we're going to be talking about what we would tell the average person, and you're going to see that your life is not that far off. That's the good news. And sex is a hard thing to talk about. I mean, it is difficult to talk to somebody about their sexuality. It's kind of embarrassing. It's really intimate. It's the ultimate in rejection if somebody, per se, does not want to wait and they rush things. Oh, they may get sex, but the relationship is probably not going to be nearly as healthy. So I'm excited to be talking about this topic on the show. Now, I got to apologize for last week. You know, I told you I was going to be on the air, and I'll be doggone if I could not. I was in a rural area, and I could not get an internet connection. And I was with a whole group of people on my vacation, and they said, you are going to do the show when you're on vacation? And I said, absolutely. I cannot wait to do the show. And I went back into my office and got things set up and couldn't get internet connection no matter what I did. And I just realized, okay, you got to give it up. And I never fail you guys. I mean, I am a believer in being available 24/7 when it comes to, you know, if I'm on vacation, it would be fine if I wanted to take the week off. But I also don't think doing an extra hour of radio is that big of a deal. I love doing that stuff. And so for me, it's an added experience. It's an added fun thing to do on my vacation. Kind of silly, huh? But at the same time, I love it. So I was disappointed too. And I'm going to see if I can pull it up right now. I've got a link for our new book called Sexual Addiction, Wisdom from the Masters. And I've been talking a little bit about this, but I didn't want to give it too much hype until it was actually published and ready to go. This is an internet e-book. And so you can get it on Amazon, you can get it at Barnes & Noble, and you can get it directly from a site, and I'm going to have it put on my my website, Sex Help with Carol the Coach. But in the meantime, I wanted you to know how you could get it, because I have interviewed on my radio show some of the greatest experts and authors ever. And for $9.99, you can buy this book. Not one single penny goes to me. I am donating all proceeds, literally all proceeds, to AFAR. That's the American Federation of Addiction Research, so that we can get to know more and more and more about sexual addiction and get funding for it, maybe get insurances to reimburse when people need residential or hospitalization. I mean, it's really pathetic that we have to fight so hard to get medical care. And so it's just really important for me that we raise money. So I want you to get this book. This book is, in actuality, transcripts from my show that I have actually audited and edited to some degree, so that you will get the gist of what I'm talking about. I interview Patrick Carnes on this in this book. He is the guru of sexual addiction. Amazing. And he talks about how the suffering of sexual addiction truly, absolutely, truly creates the most growth. And that's the good news, isn't it? I mean, that the suffering you're experiencing right now is going to grow you strong. And there is nothing better than that. So he gives you hope, strength, and recovery. There's just no doubt about it. He is founder of Sexual Addiction. He helped to write the Green Book. He developed the beginning of treatment centers. He's the father of sexual addiction. And then I interviewed Ken Adams, and boy, he does a great job of talking about the intensives that he has to offer, as well as he talks about enmeshment between mothers and sons. And so, truly, he is the expert on this niche. You know, so many of our sex addicts absolutely have difficulty with relationships with their mother. So if you think that you're overly involved with your mom, then you need to definitely read this story in Sexual Addiction, Wisdom from the Masters. Hey, I'm still looking for that link. I can't believe I don't have it up. You can tell this is my first day back from my vacation where I had so much fun. Other people in the book include Barbara Steffens, who has started the Partner Program. She certifies partners. I'm 3 hours away from having my certification. I've been trained, but I don't have that certification yet. That's very good. And we've got Alex Kadahakis, who does a lot of healthy sexuality. She's amazing. And we have we have 12 people total. I'm even in it. I talk about defense mechanisms and what are the things that keep you in denial. And one thing that I know to be true is that when you are in denial, that's the first task that we have to break. We have to figure out what to do to get you out of denial so that you can absolutely get healthy and happy and find true recovery. So I cannot stress enough how important that is. All right. So while we are talking to Danielle, a female sex addict who is participating in sober dating, I will also look for that link because I would love for you to buy it directly from eBookit. That is who I have worked so hard with. This has been edited several times, and like I said, all proceeds go to the research for sexual addiction. So you'll be doing your part to buy this book, and I'm going to beg you and plead you. I said, I'm going to tell every professional I know. I'm going to tell all my clients. I am hyping this book because this is the way to go. It is so important, to be able to increase the research so that we have absolute data that proves that sexual addiction does exist. And unfortunately, too many people do not know that. They think that it's just people acting badly. All right, here is the link. I want you to think about this. The link is www.bookit.com, Sexual Addiction, Wisdom from the Masters. And if you actually email me at carolthecoach@aol.com, I will send you that link. It's $9.99. It is a steal. I'm telling you, next to Sex Addictions Anonymous Green Book or the White Book, Sexaholics Anonymous, it's going to be the new Bible on just kind of the basics for sexual addiction. You can check yourself and go, whoa, I do all these things. Or you can say, wow, this was great. You know, this was a great, great validation of what I'm doing right and what I need to work on and resources I need to know about and programs that are available. So again, that book is called Sexual Addiction, Wisdoms from the Masters, and you can go to ebookit.com and then put in Sexual Addiction, Wisdoms from the Masters. I want you to buy this book. It's all for research. Okay. And I do believe that I have Danielle on the phone, and she's going to be talking about sober dating and sexual addiction. So, Danielle, welcome to the show.
Hey, good evening. How are you doing tonight?
Well, I'm doing well, and this is such a good topic for any of us to be talking about because, you know, I deal with people in general that don't know how to proceed with sex or how to refrain from sex when they're dating. And when you've got a sexual addiction and you're in recovery, the rules kind of change a little bit. You have to be more cautious. So can you tell me a little bit about what sober dating means to you?
Absolutely. At this point, sober dating for me means that I have no ulterior motives underneath why I'm connecting with someone, meaning that I'm not looking to escape any of my life circumstances, or I'm not feeling addicted or compulsive to whatever it is that I'm doing with someone else. And ultimately, I can take it or leave it. When I get into these spaces where I have to have a certain something, look a certain way, I understand that it's probably something I shouldn't be doing. So sober dating looks like all the pressure's off for me. It looks like me showing up fully self-supporting emotionally, physically, spiritually, and mentally.
Okay, so part of sober dating and kind of the pathway that you take depends on how many cravings or urges there are either in that relationship or in sex itself or in that type of closeness or intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and tell me how you came to believe in sober dating.
I came to believe in it through working the steps with a sponsor who'd also worked the steps with a sponsor. I think that's extremely important. And attending lots and lots and lots of meetings, Sex Addicts Anonymous meetings as well as Sex Love Addicts Anonymous meetings. I attend more of the latter lately, the sex and love addiction, because I feel like for me it's both and I needed the program that addresses both aspects of that. But I came to believe in sober dating and sitting in meetings and listening to what others said caused them trouble around connection or in connections that they were already in. And I just started plugging it in for myself. I have a dating plan that I sat down and wrote out with my sponsor, and I don't follow it perfectly, let me just say. But I have some parameters around how to conduct myself when I show up in dating situations. I've never had that before. And so having that serenity and freedom to show up in these spaces knowing that I already have something planned, right, because if we fail to plan, we plan to fail. So when I show up with intention and purpose, then it feels a lot better than it's ever felt before, and that's how I came to believe in dating soberly.
I know that your plan would be different than anybody else's plan. They're all very unique, and they're customized based on love addiction, your sexual addiction, your needs, your boundaries, that kind of thing. Can you give people an idea of what your plan would look like? I mean, as you said, you don't follow it perfectly,
Sure.
Can you give us kind of an idea of what that looks like?
I can. So for me, I don't go to anyone's home or invite anyone to my home in the first few weeks of dating. More than a few weeks, actually. It just depends on the situation, of course. But that's triggering for me. I have a background where I largely thought all I was good for was sexual activity. And so it's triggering for me to be in someone's home with them alone in the early stages of us getting to know each other, because ultimately I think that that means I have to be sexual with them if that comes up. So I don't do that, and I don't invite individuals to my home early on and getting to know them. We meet in public places. I book in my dates with my sponsor. I don't always do that, but I try to do that regularly, where I will call and talk with them, and then afterwards let them know what's going on, you know, what time I got in, et cetera. That feels good for me. And like I said, I don't always do that, but I do it enough to where I know that I know when I'm not doing it, that it feels a little different than when I am. The whole sexual thing, I don't engage in sex with someone that I haven't known for a certain amount of time. And that varies depending on the comfort level of a connection. But prior to sex, there's always full disclosure for me. Before I begin a sexual relationship with someone, I let them know about my trauma. I experienced sexual abuse as a child, and that's important to me, that someone that I'm going to be connecting with in a physical way knows that, because certain things come along with that for me and my comfort level. And I also talk with individuals about my participation in SLAA before I engage in a physically intimate relationship with them, because I need all these things to be known and out on the table so that they can be respected and so that I'm respecting them as well. So in a sense, what I'm saying is I have these boundaries, these touch points that I can go back to clearly and see, okay, I missed that or I didn't do that. My roadmap, I guess, is what I would call it.
Oh, say that again. It's your what?
My roadmap.
Your roadmap. Okay. And so your action plan that helps to keep you safe and it helps to keep you creating healthy decisions with another person involves the following. Let's see if I got these right. I think I was missing one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You said, when you start dating, you don't invite somebody back to the house.
No.
That is a boundary for you. And I agree. When you invite somebody back to the house, oftentimes they think, oh, this is an invitation for sex. And even if you don't mean it to be such, sometimes the addict in you, whether it's the love addict or the sex addict, will say, oh, come on, he or she knows that, you know, you just want coffee and you just want to talk. Truly, because of your vulnerability and because of your habits, you keep yourself safe by not putting yourself in that situation to begin with, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And then you said that when you do decide to have sex, you have a full disclosure. And it's interesting because I was talking to a gentleman tonight who they were on their first date, and he said, I might be a sex addict. And he went on to talk a little bit about himself. She went on to talk about her trauma and the fact that men had always abused and used her. And then they decided that they probably shouldn't date. Now,
mm-hmm.
He was in our group, and I said, guys, he did dating 101 wrong. What did he do
mm-hmm.
that was wrong? There were 10 guys in the group, and not one of them picked up on the fact that he told her he disclosed that information on the first date. And actually, one guy said, I really admire the fact that you shared right up front who she was going to meet and what she was getting into. But the truth of the matter is, it takes all of us several dates to be able to figure somebody out. And you don't have to confess that in the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth date until you decide you want to take your relationship to the next level. And that's why
yes.
you said, if I'm going to have sex with somebody, I'm going to fully disclose.
Yes. And that situation that you just described with that gentleman, I have experienced that more than once. And I mean experienced it, meaning I was the one that was playing the part of the gentleman. I have gone on dates and I have been so nervous and so anxious, you know, and feeling so uncomfortable that I would start just vomiting words all over this other person around, you know, my recovery, my background, my abuse, my trauma, my this. And it's too much. It's too much too soon. For me, at least, that was too much too soon, and apparently for them as well, because I'm not seeing any of them at this time. I think that's a key indicator. It's for me, it's this slow. I'm learning how to have this slow and steady pace in dating. I have been one to want to rush into something with someone when I discover that there is some camaraderie or some chemistry there with them, and nobody likes pressure. And we can feel as adults, I think, when we're being pressured or when someone has some unspoken expectations of us around dating, and it's uncomfortable, and we flee, which as we should, I think, because if I'm just meeting someone and date one, and not saying that gentleman's approach was off, I'm just saying if I was meeting someone and it was our first date and I'm disclosing to them something as personal as I may be, and he didn't even say he was, he said he maybe a sex addict. So that would have been a red flag for me because I would have thought he doesn't even know if he is or isn't. So is he still acting out? You know, what's he got going on? Is he going to try to accost me in some kind of way? Am I safe? So that would have brought up all kind of red flags and triggered alarms in my brain if someone would say that to me on the very first date.
You got it. And, you know, my point to him was, when you're dating, you're just basically sharing little bits and pieces of yourself until you decide how invested you want to be with that person. And you shouldn't know on date one, two, or three. It really should take about 6 or 9 dates to decide, yeah, I want to sleep with this guy, and yeah, or woman, and yeah, I want to share. I do believe in sharing that information.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't be sexually intimate with somebody if they don't know, if they don't know some of the vulnerabilities with you, and if you're a drug addict, alcoholic, sex addict, workaholic, spendaholic, you know, it is important that you share that prior to having sex, because sex is a connection, and it's
mm-hmm.
an intimate connection.
I agree, and responsibility comes along with it. And I feel like that's the piece that I left out for so many years prior to getting into program. You know, I thought, hey, this is just fun. This is just something I'm doing. I don't have a lot of investment in some of these situations. And there's responsibility that comes along with engaging someone in a sexual relationship, because I want the person that I'm engaged in sex with to feel like he or she has a responsibility to me, you know. So
mm-hmm.
I feel like we have to do the work on ourselves first. And I read something in my text for the SLAA program recently that really struck me. And I'm paraphrasing, but I think I'm kind of spot on with it. It said we can't find ourselves in the middle of a sexual oasis when we're in an emotional desert. So
uh-huh.
for me, that meant I can't, I guess I could, but I choose not to at this time, engage in these sexual connections with individuals if I'm not doing the hard, you know, the hard work on myself, taking a look at certain things that make me show up the way that I do, ways that I want to improve on showing up, ways that I don't want to show up as at all. Just I have to continuously be doing that work on myself while I'm in the process of dating or considering engaging someone else in a relationship of some sort.
Well, 100%. And that's why truly, so oftentimes when anybody enters any kind of recovery program, they say, wait a year. If you're single, wait a year before you start dating, because you have to develop that your emotional, your spiritual, your intellectual, your social, your physical development. You have to know that before you're really going to be ready for somebody else.
Yes, I call that recovery capital. We have to build up our recovery capital before we can start investing in certain
recovery capital,
situations.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tell me, you know, It's interesting. I have worked with a dating coach that actually teach classes, and she's very, very wise. She, when I've interviewed her for other radio shows, she believes in spending 3,000 hours with somebody before you have sex. But she says, Carol, I don't want anybody who's listening to me, I don't want to say that up front because I'll scare the bejeebies out of them. That's a long time. And what we do know is the average couple, not anybody in recovery, but the average couple has 3 to 6 dates and then they have sex. So on the third mm-hmm. date they may have sex, the fourth date they may have sex, fifth or sixth date. That's the average.
Mm-hmm.
And with people in recovery, I say it's okay to go longer. You know, it's actually advised because you really want to make sure that this is a person that you want to disclose information to. It's not just mm-hmm. about the sex. It's about developing that emotional intimacy. That really should be there before the physical intimacy. And what we know about sexual addiction is that it is a disorder of emotional intimacy. You know, mm-hmm. sex addicts usually are not good at being vulnerable, being honest, and being close. You know, usually due to trauma in their own childhoods. What do you think mm-hmm. about that?
You said a lot there. Actually, I had to, like, look at my calculator and say, wow, 3,000 hours. So I took that and divided 24 hours into the day. So that's 125 days, roughly, of course. And you're not going to spend entire days probably with someone you're dating initially. But I would agree with you in saying that it may be helpful for someone in recovery to push the time out a little longer than maybe the average couple would who's functioning properly emotionally. I know for myself, there are certain things there that I have to work through on my own in dating situations because of, just like you said, the trauma that I encountered as a child. I have to check in and make sure that I feel safe regularly. And that's a process that takes weeks of getting to know someone. So before I'm even really engaged in whether or not I like someone, how they show up, you know, how they treat others, et cetera, I am continuously checking in with myself to even make sure I feel safe in the situation. And once it's established for me that I feel safe in the situation, it isn't compulsive, it isn't obsessive, I'm not secretive, you know, I'm letting my sponsor know what's going on and other support people know what's happening in the situation. And then slowly I start moving into, okay, what we have in common. You know, what are some of the things we don't have in common? What are some of the things that makes this person tick? What makes me tick about this person? So I do feel like there may be some benefit in taking longer to get to know someone for someone in recovery. But also I feel like, too, it depends on the people, right? Because I feel like there are those situations where we meet that person that we may have a connection with that's somewhat instant, meaning it doesn't take as long as some other connections. So I feel both and about that. I'd like to leave it kind of, you know, open.
You know, people in the program, you know how they always say, don't 13th step. If somebody's just started in a program, it is not okay to make any kind of romantic advances towards them. You've been in the program how long, Danielle?
I've been in the program almost 7 years. It'll be 7 years in November.
And have you ever dated anybody in the program?
Now, I'm going to get extremely honest with you here, Carol. I've never dated someone healthily in a program. I had an affair with a married person while I was in program. But I have not dated someone else that was also single. Mm-hmm.
And since you're talking honesty, would you be mm-hmm. willing, and you know you can pass on anything, would you
sure.
be willing to share how you believe your trauma helped to create your sex and love addiction and how that has contributed to dating issues you've had in the past.
Sure. So my trauma started very early. I began being abused sexually around the age of 5. And so this five-year-old, you know, had no clue what was going on with my body or why it was going on. But what did happen for me is that this switch was flipped where I started to believe certain things that weren't true. One, I started to believe that my body wasn't mine, meaning that anyone should be able to have access to it with very little investment. Anyone could have access to me. Two, I started to believe that all I was good for was sex. I didn't know that there were other parts about me that made me interesting, like my personality, you know, my character traits, how I show up in the world. All I thought that I was good at was sex, because of that happening to me at such a young age. And also, with that switch being flipped, it completely turned on the obsession around the feelings that come from sex. And so by the time I was maybe 10 or 11 years old, I was masturbating compulsively and obsessively. I got my hands on pornography at a pretty young age, and so I would watch it in excess. And I would chase after children. Well, at that time, my preteen, I started being sexually active when I was about 13 years old. So I would chase after individuals for sexual encounters. I would be very promiscuous in the way that I showed up and conducted my sexual self, because at 13 or 14 years old, I didn't know how to conduct a sexual self. So I just did whatever I was led to do. And it was reckless and very terrible. And so those patterns continued on with me into adulthood where, and also something that I failed to mention is I never came to understand what intimacy actually looked like. I did not understand that I could be so intimate with someone without ever having a sexual desire for them. And I learned that through the program, through having sponsors and other fellowship people who I have never even considered or had a thought of being sexual with them. But we have some of the most intimate connections that I've ever had, because we share our vulnerabilities and our weaknesses with each other. And we share our strengths as well and see each other triumph over certain things. So I had no idea what intimacy meant. I had no idea that I owned my body and that I could use it how I chose to. And I had no idea that I didn't have to spend my entire day either fantasizing about or chasing after or thinking about something sexual. That's what happened with me according to my trauma. And that has been the pattern up until I made my way into Sex Addicts Anonymous meetings. So I've been in recovery altogether for almost 7 years, but I've been participating in Sex Addicts Anonymous meetings for almost 2 years. It'll be 2 years in September.
And what is the difference between Sex Addicts Anonymous and Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, SLAA?
The difference for me feels like I attended several Sex Addicts Anonymous meetings when I lived in another area. And what it felt like for me was those meetings specifically focused on the physical addiction to sex. Like, we spent a lot of those meetings talking about the actual acting out. You know, we'd have people check in around prostitution and how they couldn't stop that. We've had people check in around pornography and how they had to watch that and then masturbate excessively, or how people would cruise in parks and residential areas and, you know, things like that. For me, I experienced that to be more focused on stopping the behavior of compulsive, obsessive, sexual acting out. My Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous meetings, they address that facet of the addiction, but they also address the interpersonal relationships that are screwed up around sex, relationships, dating, families of origin type stuff. You know, I find more of a, for me, it feels more encompassing in Sex and Love Addiction means of the whole spiritual malady. You know, it's not just about the physical aspect of sex for me. It's also about what comes along with my emotional space, my mental space, what I think about myself, approval seeking, you know, commitment phobe behavior, things like that I find being addressed in the sex and love addiction meetings.
And so, truly, the difference is dependency you have for somebody in terms of a relationship and having them validate you as a person. And
absolutely.
And sometimes that involves sex and sometimes it doesn't, versus sex addiction, which is around compulsive and obsessive sexual behaviors, which sometimes
yes.
has to do with some love, but more often than not,
mm-hmm.
it's really about the obsessive and compulsive behaviors.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, you have made it your mission to educate people, and
mm-hmm.
are you a sponsor?
I am.
Okay. And yet you mentioned that in coming up with your sober dating plan, you very much would check in with your sponsor to make sure you were on the right track. Can you say
yes.
a little bit more about that?
Yes. My sponsor knows everyone that I'm dating. And at one point recently, there were a couple people that I was getting to know. He knows each of them by name. It's actually astounding. He will call them by name. We will have thorough discussion about what my intentions are with each person that I'm dating. I will check in with, am I feeling respectful towards this person? Am I feeling respected from this person? I will check in with him around what activities we're doing. I let him know when I'm going somewhere and what time I may be back after that. I just talk with him because I've come to understand that if I'm participating in something that I'm being secretive about, then there's something underneath that. We're only as sick as our secrets is what we say in the program. So I have to get all of that out, and I'm very honest with him about what I have going on. Regularly, we talk at least 2 or 3 times in the week.
Okay, and so for some of our listening audience, they may be going, okay, now why does Danielle have a male sponsor? We've heard that's a no-no to have men sponsor women or women sponsoring men. So can you explain to our listening audience why there might be an exception to your rule?
Sure, I am a lesbian, so I want nothing to do with my sponsor. And at the time in Indiana, which is where I started my recovery in SAA, and it moved into SLAA, there were no women in my program. So I chose to pick a sponsor that I felt like would understand me, and so I chose him. We were attending a book study group meeting together, and I liked a lot of what he shared. I liked his recovery, his honesty, and I asked him if he would be okay with sponsoring me. And actually, before he could sponsor me, there was a whole, and I, for lack of a better description, there was a whole chain of command that we went through. He talked with his sponsor talked with his sponsor. Of course, he talked with his wife. There were a bunch of individuals who were in the decision-making process of whether or not we would be a good sponsor, sponsee match, and we've been working together now for almost 2 years.
Wow. So, you know, I oftentimes do meet female sex addicts that have male gay sponsors. And
yes.
in this situation, you being a lesbian, you felt, and there was no other females available to you. And so
no.
you pick somebody that, just like almost anybody else can, they say, I want what he has or I want what she has. And
yes.
then it went through a chain of commands where everybody held each other accountable. He talked with
mm-hmm.
his wife. He got her okay. He talked with his sponsor. He got his okay. Now there are more women in the program.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any women in the program in our area, because you are working in our area, that have more sobriety than you do?
I imagine there are. Yeah. I imagine
okay.
there are. And some of the meetings
do you
that
know
I
any?
Attend, I am new to the area that I'm in right now. So I've been attending meetings for a little over 6 months. I've been living in this area. So I know of some women who have more recovery than I do. I attend meetings with them. But even my meetings that I attend now, I attend about 3 or 4 meetings a week. And collectively in each of them, there are probably about 10 women. And I would say of those 10 women, probably maybe half or a little under half have more recovery than I do.
Okay, because I clearly know that, you know, you have been in recovery for 7 years. That doesn't mean you did it perfectly. It doesn't mean you didn't have any slips or relapses. You have been working very diligently, and you take things very seriously. I mean,
I do.
When do you think it shifted for you, and how did you notice the difference?
Well, I'm in a couple different programs, I think I've mentioned. So my longest standing program has been Overeaters Anonymous. And I had to come to understand that I am a compulsive overeater. I won't talk much about that. I'm a two-hatter, and I know how that goes. But I had to come to understand that there was a spiritual malady there around my eating. But the way my addictions work, and I think the way addiction works in general, is it's almost like all of them are on this linked chain. And when my food is out of control, it's only a certain amount of time when my sexual relations are out of control. And when my sexual relations are out of control, it's only a matter of time before my codependency is out of control. And so for me, things started shifting when I started to feel life get better. I got my food in a proper perspective, meaning it was, you know, I was right-sized to it. It was right-sized to me. So I wasn't completely stuffing myself until I felt sick. And then when that stopped happening, then other things came to the surface like, okay, I am feeling better. I am looking better. Why is there still something inside of me that feels broken? And from there, I started to talk in my OA meetings about how I would watch pornography in excess. I said it maybe once or twice, actually. And I had someone come to me and say, hey, there's a program for that, you know. And so I ended up attending a meeting for SAA, and then I started doing the work in there, and from there I started doing the work around healing the sexual trauma from my childhood. I participated in a 10-week support group for sexually abused women. I've like seen a therapist off and on for the last 10 years of my life. So all of these things kind of started coming together to address the issues in the whole person. You know, it wasn't ever just the food. It wasn't ever just the sex. It wasn't ever just the family dynamics. It's all of the above. And so I really started to take these things seriously when I started to see how they all hinged on each other, and that I had to do work and have to do work every single day to address these issues and stay above compulsion and obsession.
Well, absolutely, and I'm so glad that you mentioned your eating issues, your compulsive overeating. Because, you know, whether it be anorexia, bulimia, compulsive overeating, one of the things that we know is when you are plagued with a sexual addiction, you probably have some other addiction that goes along with it. Maybe it's mainstream and dangerous is workaholism. Maybe it's drug addiction. Maybe it's alcoholism. Maybe it's an eating disorder. Maybe it's a spending disorder, gambling, but there usually is a second, if not even a third, addiction that walks side by side. So here you were just kind of shooting the breeze with people, letting them know what you were doing, and they gave you a heads up and they said, hey, this is probably a problem and here's a meeting you can go to for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Beauty of a 12-step meeting is that people help to hold you accountable, don't they?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. This is my first attempt at living. I say this in meetings sometimes. My 12-step experience is my first attempt at living a principled lifestyle. And the people in my life are the ones who make it so rich because of what you just said. I have countless accountability partners. Someone that I can call any time of day. You know, I've had times where I've had to make a call to someone in the middle of the night, you know, and they answer to talk with me about what was going on. I have felt so supported, and I've been that support for others as well. And we keep giving back. You know, we can't keep what we don't give away is what we say as well. So it's so rich to see my life change as a result of someone else investing in me, and then I can see others' lives change as I invest in them. It's really a beautiful thing.
Well, absolutely, and it's what we call a family of choice. And when you create that family of choice, then you actually have the support that you deserve. Probably more support as an adult than you had as a kid.
I would agree with that 110%. Yes, I would agree with that 110%. And I've come to see just how important it is to have support. And when I say that, I also wanted to be clear. I was supported as a child. As I've gotten through some of the issues that I've presented with, I've come to understand that my family is a very loving, supportive family. They did the best they could with what they knew how to do. And yet and still, the kind of support that I receive now in recovery is the kind of life that I need to continue to function properly one day at a time. Perfectly imperfect is how I'm learning to show up in the world as I continue to be supported by other individuals who are showing up that way as well.
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, I remember when you first got on the show, 45 minutes ago, and you were saying that it was your word choice. You said, I chose to do it this way. And oftentimes, mm-hmm. part of the program is not just about how do you deal with sexual addiction, but it's how do you create support. What do you do that is actually a healthy choice as opposed to a sense of deprivation? What symptom substitutions are actually going to make you feel better about yourself? And it's a whole new way of life, and it really does transform you. And clearly, you know, that spiritual transformation is often part of the 12-step program. Now, a lot of people don't connect sex and dating with spirituality. Do you do that?
Yes, I do. And I didn't always, but I do. And even in our big book text, which, you know, all 12-step programs branched off from Alcoholics Anonymous, which was the first one. In that text, it talks about, and I can't remember specifically where, and I'm paraphrasing, but it says our sex powers are God-given. Right, you know, and we mm-hmm. and how we use them demonstrates how we feel about ourselves and our higher power. And that's the part I'm paraphrasing. And I understand that nothing in my life happens on a whim as a result. Just happens, right? Nothing happenstance for me. My higher power is guiding and directing. I call my higher power God. God for me is directing the show entirely. Unless I try to start directing it, and then that's an issue of a whole other proportion. But my sexual self, my dating self, all of myself is directed by God. And that's what has changed for me most in being in this program. I'm understanding that there were these moments in my life where I felt so damaged that I thought I had to take the wheel and steer myself the way that I wanted to be steered. And, you know, I feel like there's entitlement that comes along in trauma, at least in mine. I felt so hurt and abused by everyone that I felt entitled to be a complete hedonist is how I felt. And then I started to understand that what I was really doing is re-injuring myself. I was making the same trauma continue to come about that I had experienced. I was doing it to myself. And that's what this program helps. It helps me get out of the habit loop. It helps me to trust my higher power and turn my will and my life over to her one day at a time, understanding that every person I'm supposed to meet, every encounter I'm supposed to have, every situation that's supposed to show up, it will. It always has. It always will. And I'm powerless over sex addiction. I am powerless over compulsive overeating, but I am not powerless over footwork. I do the footwork by continuing to show up, you know, using the tools, working the steps, and my higher power meets me, and I've been taking some places that are just beyond my wildest dreams, and I have seen some habits that I've presented with since I was a child completely dissolve. And there are others, of course, that still need work, and I'll be working on them for the rest of my life. But just who I am and who I'm becoming is absolutely astounding to me. I don't know me some days, and that's a great thing.
Oh, absolutely. Well, as we begin to end the show, I'm going to ask you, is there anything else you would like for our listeners to know about sober dating, sex addiction, sex and love addiction and recovery?
I would like listeners to know that recovery is possible. I feel like sometimes we get into these places where we think our habits are so strong, or our trauma is so heavy, or what we've experienced is pushing us down so low that we can't get up. And I can understand that feeling because I've been there, but I can also understand the feeling of liberation and transformation and reformation and reconciliation. I said a lot there, but I understand that it's possible one day at a time as we show up and do the work. So I want listeners to understand that no habit you present with can't be changed. No trauma you've experienced can't be worked through. We are lovable. We've made mistakes in addiction, but we are not a mistake. We've made them, but we are not one, and we all are here for a reason. And who knows, we may be the only text from SLAA that some other person may get the opportunity to experience. So I like to show up as best as I can one day at a time, carrying the message very imperfectly, carrying the message yet and still.
Well, very good point. And I know that the cliffhanger here is that a lot of people fear that sober dating means that they'll never be able to have sex. And I want to be very clear with our listening audience that there may be some guidelines. It's very clear as a relationship coach and as a mental health therapist that I want our listeners to go slow, and I want them to really work on developing all aspects of a personal relationship before they dive into sex. I actually want sex to come last only because I think that the relationship will be better for it. But there are no numbers. You know, I got that relationship coach saying 3,000 hours. You heard me saying 3 to 6 dates. It's really an individual choice. It's based on consulting with your head, your heart, your gut, and fellowship, your sponsor, and people that you absolutely can trust. And Danielle, that is clearly what you have done in your action plan. You check in with people and really put it out there to get feedback as well as to hear what you have to say. It's as much about hearing your own voice as anybody else's.
Mhm. Very true. And all that you said there was great. Absolutely. And also I want to throw out there, I used to feel the same way because I had a period of abstinence where I wasn't sexual at all. I did not date at all with my sponsor, and I complained with him about how much I missed dating and being sexual. And he would say to me, no one's ever died from a lack of sex. And he was absolutely correct, but I still complained. But what I'm also experiencing now, Carol, is that when I take the time to get to know someone and let them get to know me, and we actually exchange energy, and we become friends, and we start to care for each other, and then we allow things to naturally proceed into a sexual, physical connection. Oh, it's so much better than anything I've ever experienced. It's just wonderful to
excellent.
Know.
Absolutely excellent. Well,
yeah.
You're very good at this topic because clearly most of us didn't have any role modeling when it came to talking about sex, and that's what makes this issue tough to begin with, let alone complicate it with sexually addictive behaviors and love addictive behaviors. So, Danielle, thank you so much for putting yourself out there, sharing your thoughts and beliefs. I'm sure everyone will really benefit from your honesty, your rigorous honesty, your openness, and your hope, strength, and recovery.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. You have a good evening and a good rest of the week, too.
All right. I hope to talk to you soon, and I know I will. Thank you, Danielle.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So that was a sex addict and a sex and love addict, and she was talking about sex, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Now, next week, we are going to be talking to Michael Morton, who is part of Keystone Treatment Center, a wonderful treatment center that has helped several of my clients. And I ran into him in February at ITAP, and I said, hey, I want to have you on the show. I want to hear about the programs that you're offering right now. And again, and hope, strength, and recovery that can be gained from intensive programs. And as I say to you at the end of every show, you know, there will only be one of you at all times. So I want you to fearlessly have the faith and the courage to be yourself. Don't forget, I'm really hoping that you are going to buy Sexual Addiction, Wisdom from the Masters. You can go to Amazon, you can go to Barnes & Noble, and you can get it from ebookit.com. Just put in my name, Carol the Coach, my other name, Carol Sheets, or Sexual Addiction, and it'll come right up. And when you buy that book, ebook gets a little bit of the money, but all the other proceeds, every bit of it, and I spent a couple thousand dollars on this book, every bit of it goes to research, and I just want to raise a bunch of money for them. So please, don't hesitate. Do it right now for me. You know, let's build this research program together so that people will understand that this is not just a passing fancy. This is not people acting badly. It is an obsessive and a compulsive problem that recovery tools, right therapy, right treatments will help. I hope I've given you hope, strength, and recovery tonight, and I look forward to seeing you next week. Have a good one.